You're listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Miles to Go podcast. First up this week is a discussion on a new airplane that you're going to be flying sooner than I would have thought that's going to bring a lot more comfort to the air. We've got another It's a Big Deal segment, and then we're going to round out with some information on how to make sure you get the maximum amount you're entitled to if you have a flight cancellation. Before we get into the show, though, I ask you for a quick favor. If you're enjoying the show, I hope you'll do us a favor and click the subscribe button, whether that's on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, you know, wherever you're listening to this podcast. And also, if you like the show, if you, you know, click on give us a rating. Those two things help us show the show off to more folks, and that's definitely what we want. We want to make sure that we can grow the audience as much as possible. With that, we're going to jump into this week's episode. And our first segment is brings Seth back to the show from PaxX.Aero, and it's about an airplane that I first discovered, gosh, probably 6 or 7 years ago that I actually never thought would fly in the U.S. Seth, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being on. As I recall, you were back over in Europe again recently for the launch of a plane that I'll never really be able to call the Airbus A220, but as I'll affectionately always refer to it as the Bombardier C-Series.
Yeah, I was actually over in Toulouse, got to hang out with the folks at Airbus, and you know, it's interesting to hear you describe it as a new plane and this and that. It's new branding, but it's definitely not a new plane. And as you alluded to, it was known as the C-Series. It was the Bombardier's newer single aisle. It's sort of their largest, but the small single aisle competitor. So it's got two different versions. It can seat from anywhere from about 110 up to 150 or so passengers, depending on how tight the airline wants to make it and which model they pick. And as you said, it really is going to actually start flying in the United States soon. And more than, even more than I thought, having been tracking it for a little while now. So it's going to be, it's coming soon. And that's good news, I think, is really the story there.
Yeah, I think it's good news as well for passengers. And I think, you know, when I think back to, so the short version is a number of years ago, I was on an aviation geek excursion up in Canada. We went to Bombardier and they showed us this new plane called the C-Series. And back then it was literally just a fuselage and some models. And back then, they made the point that they really didn't ever expect this plane to fly in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. And, you know, while we could go deep down the rabbit hole, the short answer is due to things like scope clauses with certain airlines and, you know, the number of seats the plane was expected in the beginning to be, which was somewhere between, call it 95 and 110. It just didn't seem like there was a place in the U.S. market for it. And now you've got two airlines that have placed, well, one airline that's placed a fairly sizable order for the C-Series, and a hypothetical airline that we do hope comes to fruition that has also placed a large order.
And there's actually a third that you're forgetting about, which is going to take delivery later this year.
Oh, Delta. Delta
is the largest customer so far.
I completely forgot that Delta had placed the order. I mean, I forget, but it's, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Between Delta and JetBlue, we've got two legitimate airlines that will actually be flying this plane. And the hope that the brainchild behind JetBlue will bring it back in an airline to be named later.
Quite literally to be named later.
Quite literally, because the first name isn't going to work.
Well, yeah. Did you see his comment? He named it Moxie. It's right. Sort of their internal project name. And he admits that that was never the name of the airline. But once the name got public, the folks at Marriott got pretty upset with him.
I just don't. I mean, knowing that you were going to have to change the name, why wouldn't you just change it? Even if why wouldn't you use a placeholder that was just a wee bit less likely to get, you know, somebody mad at you?
Do you know a little bit of trivia here? Do you know the original name for JetBlue?
No.
Taxi.
What was it?
Taxi.
Oh.
Which, putting aside the issues with air traffic control, like taxi on, taxi on taxiway alpha, that would be a problem. But they ended up deciding, they at one point it was going to be like yellow and black checkerboard livery. They were going to do it up with the whole taxi theme being based in New York City. And they ended up not doing it for a whole variety of reasons. Among them, the connotation of being associated with taxis was not considered especially positive.
I can't imagine any reason why they would think that. But that's really cool. I did not know that.
It's So a little bit of added trivia that's completely off topic and unrelated to anything we're talking about today.
Which is no different for how we normally record podcast segments. I would love it if you would roll through a few of the things that the C-Series has that make me excited about why I think passengers are really going to like flying on it.
Sure. So it is it's not quite a regional jet. It's a little bigger than your traditional regional jets. And if you're used to the 50-seaters, it's way bigger. It's 5 seats across in a 2-3 layout, and the seats are 18 inches wide at a minimum. So that's a lot of space going across. Unlike sort of the 787 or 777s, where it was designed for one seat width and then the airlines figured out how to squeeze an extra seat in the row, that's not going to happen on this plane. So you're going to have those nice wide seats no matter what. There is a middle seat, but only on one side. And one of the interesting things that Bombardier did in the original design and that Airbus is keeping is that the middle seat can be an inch wider. So you get a little bit of a reward for getting stuck in the middle seat.
And if I remember correctly, too, when they originally mapped this out, didn't they map out a slightly wider aisle as well?
Yeah.
Or is that staying?
Yeah, it's a wide aisle as well. It is a wide fuselage for what it is. And what's interesting thing about that is, you know, arguably that's bad for fuel efficiency. It's bad for sort of the nitty gritty detail side of things. But because it's a new wing, a new engine, all these other new avionics, new sort of fully designed aerodynamics, even with that slightly too wide, so to speak, fuselage, they come out ahead on the fuel efficiency to the tune of 20-30% versus some of the similar sized aircraft today. And that ends up being compelling for the airlines, even when you'd think it wouldn't. So the airlines get their cost savings on fuel, and we as passengers get more space on board. So everybody's happy.
Yeah, and I think I remember them saying this back when it was up in Canada, and now obviously it's moved over to Airbus, but I do remember Bombardier saying that their plan for manufacturing the plane was to allow only one type of overhead bin that they would supply, and that bin that they showed off to us was very sizable. Have you heard anything about whether Airbus is considering making changes to that internally to fit in with other stuff they might have, or do you think that those bins get to stick around?
I think the bin stickers, everything sticks around at least initially, right? So this is a situation Airbus bought out, or it's a joint venture.
Sure.
That Airbus
we'll call it a joint venture.
More than half of and has the rights to buy the rest of. But Airbus paid $1 to buy sort of half the program and then can buy the rest of it out over time. And I expect they will over time, but it's still a joint venture today. So I have to be careful about that. But, you know, they are talking about doing things like aligning design touch points and trying to make the A220 look more similar to the 320 inside and also to the 330neo and the 350. It's what Airbus calls their airspace design concept. And they're just trying to make everything feel more consistent to the passenger. One of the things I think we talked about in Toulouse, one of the things I talked about with the folks there was things like the latches on the overhead bins. And they're not going to change immediately, but if you can imagine as an airline, if you've got, you know, a couple hundred planes and each has a couple dozen overhead bins and you've got to keep spare parts for the latches so that if when, you know, a passenger rips one off, you can replace it quickly. If you can drop from 2 parts to 1, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I definitely see the improvement in that. I would just hope that given the configuration of the cabin that they would still stick with some sort of a bin that from what it looked like, it'll hold almost double the amount of bags, if not double, that a standard overhead bin fits.
Certainly that a standard regional would fit. Yeah, the bags fit sort of wheels in or wheels out. They are huge bins, and that's one, you know, again goes back to the larger fuselage. It's one of the nice things that you get out of it. So you can stand up inside. You can actually stand up and move around in the bathroom, which is unheard of in single aisle planes. Certainly the new Boeing and Airbus labs are
horrible.
The SpaceFlex and Slimline and whatever lavatories that we're seeing are super tight. And, you know, those are the ones that the folks over at American, the flight attendants, are complaining about. And it's finally starting to get some traction on, I don't know, traction, but we're hearing more about it. The lav on the C-Series is huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot of things about it make it really nice for passengers. The Delta version is going to have the GoGo 2KU product installed straight from the factory.
Oh, that's
so
great.
You'll have Wi-Fi on board from day one. And Delta is also committed to putting in-seat entertainment on it. None of the other airlines operating the C-Series today have that. And that's AirBaltic and Swiss and Korean are the other three flying it today.
Right.
None of them have entertainment systems in the seat right now. But Delta has committed to doing that. We'll see if that comes to fruition, but we expect to see it. And so, you know, as JetBlue does it, I would be shocked if they don't have in-seat screens, because they've made that their sort of raison d'etre from a passenger perspective, right? The in-seat screens, free Wi-Fi now and free snacks has been their shtick since day one.
Yeah.
They don't seem inclined to change that. For Moxie, Dave Neilman's gig, who knows? We still got to get to 2020, 2021 to see what actually comes of that. Those are a few years away yet, but you know, the Delta deliveries start late this year with expectation of commercial service early Q1 of 2019. And then Delta's taking the smaller model, the
100, right?
The 100, yeah. It used to be the CS100, now it's the A220-100. And that's basically going to start replacing their old MD-88s. It's a sort of like-for-like swap in size there, and also, you know, seat layout and some of those other things. The JetBlue ones are going to be the 300 model, and that's the larger plane. So that's, you know, the 140-ish seats instead of 110-ish. And one of the situations there is, I don't know, you know, you may remember there was the sort of trade war stuff where Boeing tried to file lawsuits to prevent Delta from buying the C-Series without paying hefty tariffs, because they claimed the Quebecois and Canadian governments subsidized the production costs.
Right. Right.
And that was unfair. And now that ruling came back with essentially saying that the 100 can't be, you know, hit with the tariffs that way, and it's okay. The 300 has to be made in the United States to sell in the United States. And Airbus has committed to setting up an assembly line at their facility in Mobile, Alabama, where they also have an A320 assembly line. And that's not going to come online until early 2020.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting development here in terms of, you know, how I've studied the C-Series over the years, in that when they first talked about the plane, a lot of the focus was on the smaller variant, in that they thought that their ability to gain traction was to fill a gap in between what the Boeings and Airbuses of the world were building for, you know, 737s and Airbus, you know, 320s. And, you know, the smaller Embraer and also Bombardier regional jets. And so I think, you know, when I first heard about the JetBlue order, I really did think of it in terms of them, replacing their Embraer fleet. I didn't think that they would flex up to that larger configuration. But it'll be interesting and I think encouraging to see, you know, 140, 150 seat, you know, C-Series A220 planes flying around, where we get those extra comfort elements for passengers. That means you could pop up on a lot of desirable routes, like, you know, New York to the Caribbean, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I agree with you that they sort of are trying to fit that middle ground. One of the things to remember, though, is what we used to consider a 150-seat airplane back in the day is now a 180-seat airplane.
Fair.
So, and, you know, the JetBlue new version of their A320 is going to be 162 seats. This will be 135 maybe for them, 130, 135, 140, one of the three probably.
Yeah.
They haven't announced what their config is going to be yet publicly. So, you know, it's bigger than the 100 seat. It's definitely smaller than the 160. And with the lower costs and some of the other things that it can do, you start opening up opportunities.
You do. And these planes are going to fly, you're definitely going to fly a long distance. You know, we're going to see them on, you know, some of the short haul stuff, but we should also see them on transcons. And, you know, between Delta and JetBlue, we're going to start to see them a lot sooner than I would have expected in the U.S. And we're going to see a lot more of them, which I think is ultimately going to be good for passengers overall. Seth, thanks a ton for coming on to talk about, again, I'm still going to continue to get stuck on C-Series versus A220. When you're not hanging out in the podcast with me or on your podcast at Dots, Lines, and Destinations, tell folks where they can find you.
Sure. So that's moredotsmorelines.com or at Dots, Lines on Twitter. I'm also at WANDRME. So it's misspelled and hard to figure out, but Wander Me, sort of ish. And then I've been writing about airplanes and seats and entertainment and connectivity systems at paxx.aero. the AER version, AERO version, not ARROW. I got that. Someone got confused by that the other day.
So. That's awesome. Great. Seth, thanks again for being on. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast with another It's a Big Deal segment, followed by some help on how to make sure you get compensated for canceled flights. We'll be right back.
If you're listening to this podcast, you know the places Miles and Points can take you. Maybe you've been saving up those miles and points to plan that special once-in-a-lifetime trip, but you can't find what you're looking for. The experts at BookYourReward.com have redeemed over 3 billion miles. That's billion, with a B. You won't find anyone with more experience to book your dream vacation. BookYourReward.com will provide you with concierge booking services to get you where you want to go, how you want to get there, and using the rewards program of your choice. All for a lot less than the cost of a domestic coach airline ticket. For listeners of the Miles to Go podcast, with a special limited time offer, receive a $25 Amazon gift card with your first paid booking at BookYourReward.com. Drop us a line at milestogopodcast@gmail.com with your itinerary for more details.
It's that time of the show for another It's a Big Deal segment. I've got Jen back on from Deals We Like, and we're going to talk about Wyndham Rewards today and a promotion they've got that you should be able to get a pretty decent amount of value out. Jen, thanks for coming back on and talking to us about the Wyndham Two Nights promotion that's going on right now.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to speak about this promotion, as it's one of my favorite, even though you know, might not get that much press. It's a way to really stay for free, or not for free, but for really, really, really cheap.
Yeah, I agree. So lay it out for folks. How can they earn their free night with Wyndham Rewards?
Sure. So Wyndham is kind of at it again, offering a similar promotion to that they've had over the past. This is the fourth time, I think, over the past year, where you'll receive a free night after staying two separate times. So you'll actually receive 7,500 points after your first day, and another 7,500 points after your second stay, for a total of 1,500 points. And for those in the points mile world, 15,000 points does not seem like a lot of points at all. But with Wyndham, they have this fixed redemption. So a free night is a fixed 15,000 points across the board, as long as just a one bedroom room. So it's a good way to get a free night out of Wyndham. I keep on saying free night, Ed, but it's not a free night because you have to actually stay to earn those points. But when you redeem it, it's a free night.
Well, if you're a business traveler, this is an easy way to score it as a free night. And you know, as Jen said, guys, the interesting thing about Wyndham, both good and bad, is that all rooms are the same award redemption price. It's 15,000 points at any property. So, you know, the low end properties that you'd expect to be less, are not. But the great thing is as you scale up, there are some really nice Wyndhams, around the world. Hawaii comes to mind as a place where you can get a pretty solid redemption from Wyndham. And so staying two nights somewhere, and they can't be consecutive nights at the same property, staying two nights somewhere should earn you a free night at any property, any Wyndham property in the world. The only nervous twitch I have here is, based on my recollection, I think there was a problem last time they ran this where they pulled the promotion early.
Right. So I think it was two times ago. It was back in February. And they pulled it without telling anybody. And I had a lot of readers contacting me saying, hey, I actually completed my stay. And Wyndham said that they pulled it. And if you looked in the terms and conditions, that was small little print that nobody ever reads. It did say that it could be pulled at any time, and they did pull it. Fortunately, I was able to get in contact with Wyndham, and they were able to make right for everyone, or at least folks that I put them in touch with. So that was nice, but it wasn't so great that they just pulled it without telling anyone. And now this time around, they have big bold letters when you go to register telling you that there's a limited number of points available and that it could be pulled. So this is one of the promotions that there is a good percentage, I think, that it could be pulled. So if you do plan on taking advantage of it, try to do so sooner than later. Don't wait to the very end, because you no guarantee that it will still be available. You know, other hotel promotions, if it gives a time span, it's available through that whole time span. Wyndham, not always the case.
Yeah, and I don't understand why they do it this way. I mean, if they were concerned about too many redemptions or somebody trying to do something fraudulently, I think you just limit the number of free nights somebody can earn in their own individual account. But I think setting it up this way where you're just not sure, you know, I could decide to move some business travel over in August, and then by the time I get there, I don't get the free night. And that makes it a little bit murky for me. I guess if I knew that I could get those two stays out of the way pretty quickly near the beginning of this promo period, that could be another story. But definitely makes me a little bit nervous on this one. But if you've got some Wyndham stays coming up, it can definitely be a great value for you. Jen, thanks again for being on. Tell folks where they can find you when you're not on the podcast telling everybody about deals.
Sure. You can find me at my blog, dealswelike.com, and throughout social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and at dealswelike for all three.
Awesome. Great. Thanks, Jen. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Stay tuned, guys. We'll be right back with our final segments.
This episode of Miles to Go is sponsored by GoGo In-Flight Internet. GoGo brings the internet to the sky, so planes fly smarter, airlines perform better, and passengers travel happier. Their new blazing fast 2KU antenna delivers industry-leading speeds, up to 15 megabits per passenger device, and is currently available on over 400 planes flying in over 65 countries worldwide. Get GoGo, travel happier.
Welcome back to the podcast. You know, if you've ever been stuck in an airport, you may not realize that you might have been entitled to compensation. And, you know, this might sound obvious, you know, maybe the airline owes you money because your plane was broken and you have to fight for that. But there are actually some regulations, and it with the explosion of low-cost carriers moving people back and forth between the U.S. and Europe, this comes up a lot more frequently. I see people asking these questions. And there's some legislation which we affectionately refer to as what's called EU 261. And we'll get into that in a little bit more detail here in just a minute. But I want to bring somebody on who knows a little bit more about this than me because I've never filed a claim. And Becky from sightdoing.net was gracious enough to hop on to do a podcast segment with us today. And we're going to go through just a little bit about what your rights are in certain situations. And she's going to help give us some guidance on what to do if you do end up with a flight that's either delayed or canceled. Hey, Becky, thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for bringing me on.
It's great to have you on. We've talked about having you on for a few months, and I thought maybe it would be donuts or ice cream, but I'm super excited to be talking about something that I know is going to be very instructional for listeners, especially because it's not an area where I have actual direct experience with. Unfortunately, it sounds like you do.
I do, and I would imagine probably a lot of travelers do, especially if you tend to fly a lot. So EC 261 is a European regulation basically for canceled, delayed, or denied boarding. So it can impact a lot of travelers, although I do think flight delays and cancellations are the ones that you're going to hear about most often.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's where I often do hear it. And I, like I said, knock on wood, I have had some small delays on flights to and in through Europe, but never any sort of a longer delay that might trigger 261. Let's start with what normally triggers compensation. What are, you know, triggering events?
Sure. So the main point that you need to remember here is that this will only apply to flights traveling to, through, or from the European Union. So it will not impact a lot of the other flights you might be taking worldwide, but it does apply to all flights to, through, or from the EU with a lot of caveats and fine print. So that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. And it will apply either to flights that are delayed 3 or more hours, flights that were canceled with less than 14 days notice, or if you were denied boarding on a ticket that you otherwise had a confirmed flight reservation on.
Yeah, and I think one other point I'd add here for folks trying to navigate the sea of compensation is that frequently I've heard of folks who sound like they have a claim based on my understanding of the statute, and they're told by the airline that they don't. And I think that's a very key point here is that most times that I've heard an airline say that and I've listened to the story from the traveler, based on the way the story the traveler lays out for me, it sounds like the airline's incorrect in how they're applying 261.
So it does get a little bit tricky. And the number one thing to remember, I think, is that this regulation only applies if the delay or cancellation is based on something within the airline's full control. So weather events are probably the number one disruptor of flights worldwide. They would not qualify you for this compensation. So that is considered an act of God. But even something like an air traffic control strike or an air traffic control malfunction, something that is outside of the airline's control, will give the airline that right to deny your claim, and reasonably so. It's really meant for the airline to take accountability on something within their control, something like a mechanical problem or maybe a staffing problem, something along those lines.
Yeah, I've heard of instances of people trying to, I wouldn't necessarily say this is pushing the envelope or not, but in the case where an airline might have a strike, and that's not necessarily an air traffic control issue, but you know, their flight attendants or their pilots decide to strike and they can't operate the flight. And I've heard varying results in trying to make a 261 claim for something like that.
Yeah. So for something like a strike, if it is something within the airline itself, I think it's definitely worth applying or filing that claim. So if it's their own flight attendants on strike, however, if it's something like airport staff that's on strike, people who work baggage or something along those lines, that would be outside of their control probably. And a good example of why they might not pay that out. But the good news is there are a couple of websites that can help you check on those things or help you navigate through it. A lot of it is just trying to talk through it in your own head. Is this 100% in the airline's control?
Yeah. What are some examples of websites that that you're familiar with that help folks handle these sorts of cases?
So I know of a couple. To be fair, they do all take a commission out of your compensation if you do get paid. So if at all possible, I would recommend filing on your own. But I think the biggest one is airhelp.com. There is also refund.me, refund.me. There's a couple also based in the UK that I imagine will continue to operate at least until Brexit. If you do any Google searches, there's at least half a dozen that come up on the first page. And the going rate does seem to be about 25% of your compensation. So it's a pretty big fee payment, but potentially worth it if you can't get help on your own.
Yeah, and I have heard of AirHelp, and I've heard of folks who have had positive experiences with it. And when we talk about fees as a percentage of your return, if I remember correctly, I believe that the 261 claims max out at 600 euro for the longest of flights?
They do. So 261 is based on three different tiers of flights. The first one would be a really short haul flight, something up to 1500 kilometers, which I think works out to about 950 miles. So an example of that might be something like Paris to Frankfurt. And that maxes out at 250 euro since that's a pretty short flight. But the payments do get higher the longer your flight is. So any flights from the European continent to the US, those would be in the longest tier flight, and that maxes out at 600 euros, like you said. And that would also incorporate probably most non-EU destinations. So even something like Amsterdam to Hong Kong, for example.
Yeah, and if we think about that in terms of transatlantic fares right now, there are plenty of folks I know who are buying tickets for less than 600 euro round trip, which in today's conversion dollars is probably about $700 US.
Exactly.
So it's interesting that if you have enough of a delay, you might actually get more compensation than what you paid in a ticket based on what these regulations call for, you know, based on length of time to fly from the US to Europe or back.
Absolutely. And it's also important to note that this really is compensation for your inconvenience, and that if you do have a valid travel insurance policy, whether through your credit card or through a purchase policy, you might actually still be eligible for certain refunds or costs that you accumulate along the way as well, if there are any additional meals or hotels or things like that that for some reason the airline is not picking up. Your travel insurance might still qualify for some of those on top of this compensation.
So you mentioned earlier that you had an incident that was sort of in progress. How have you found the process so far yourself in terms of filing your claim?
So to file the claim itself is actually pretty straightforward. I had a flight from Amsterdam to Newark. So that is in the longest tier flight, or more than 3,500 kilometers. And my delay was about 3 hours and 50 minutes, potentially 4 hours and 17 minutes, depending on how you count it. And how you count it will be one of those things that airlines are very much looking at as far as whether or not it counts. So there are some forms, PDF forms, you can download online and fill out that will walk you through all of the information an airline needs to even start working through this. Basically, you'll need to have your flight number, the date of travel, the cities you're traveling between, some very basic information like that. You'll also want, ideally, a printout from the airline, which they can do at gate counters or check-in counters. Stating the actual arrival time or departure time so that you can see the scheduled time and the new changed times. So you'll want that. You will also definitely want your confirmation code and your ticket number. Usually those ticket numbers are a little bit more difficult to find, but they should be on your boarding pass and hopefully in your receipts as well. And as many paper copies as you can get, or screenshots if you had mobile boarding passes. So you will want very detailed records, which will help them process it more quickly and be less likely to deny that claim.
Yeah, all great tips for making a claim, and I certainly don't have the personal experience. It sounds like yours is still in process. Will you hop back on with us once we have a resolution to let folks know how you made out?
I'd be happy to. I don't actually know how long it will take since this is the first time I've had to actually file something. But if you've ever worked with airlines before, I think you realize that as soon as you submit anything, you basically get a form response saying we'll get back to you in a week or two. And so I haven't even gotten that first response back. But I imagine that there might be two or three times back and forth even thereafter. As they try and get the information and potentially push back from me, depending on how things go. But I am working with United Airlines, so they're based in the USA. My understanding, as I've read through quite a bit of information online, is that if you do work with airlines based in the EU, they are a little bit more quick to react to it compared to those airlines that are here based in the USA or potentially somewhere else abroad.
Yeah, we won't even go down the rabbit hole of whether the US-based airlines are more likely to respond on any other normal list of correspondences versus the airlines in Europe and Asia.
Yeah, so I think the really main important piece that I'd like to just reiterate is that readers should be aware that if they are flying to, through, or from the European Union, you do have certain rights, and it is really up to you to be aware of those and to ask for those. It's probably unlikely that the airline will preemptively offer you 600 euros unless you go to them and ask. And it will be a case-by-case basis, but you need to know to even get the process started that you do have those rights if your flight is delayed or canceled on short notice, and also that you'll need all that paper trail or those details in order to work through it. So that's really something that you need to be a self-advocate for and always be proactive on your own case.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. I know there were instances in the past where airlines were proactive when there were large issues, but I don't think you can count on that. Self-advocation is so important in so many aspects of travel, and especially so for claims like this with 261. Becky, thanks a ton for being on with us today and helping educate my listeners on 261 and how to make sure that they're getting the right amount of compensation when they do have a flight delay. When you're not on the podcast with me, tell folks where they can find you.
I write about travel at sightdoing.net, and I am also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as @sightdoing.
And she likes donuts and ice cream, which means you may see us crossing paths some point in the future, raising both of our cholesterol levels.
I plead the fifth.
All right. Thanks again, Becky. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. The final two pennies this week is about planning ahead. we're midsummer now, so you should already be thinking about what you want to do for the holidays. You know, Christmas and New Year's, all that stuff is right around the corner. It might not seem like it, but this is a really good time to be hunting for awards if you want to make sure you find the right hotel or airline for the holidays. Keep in mind, you're not the only one that wants to travel that time of year. Everybody else does as well. Some of the big airlines have already opened up their schedules for the traditional spring break, March, April time. So, you know, keep an eye out for that. Southwest hasn't just yet. Their schedule's only open through March 6th right now. But keep an eye out. Sometime in the next month or so, we should see that roll over to cover spring break travel as well. Everybody else is looking to go to the exact same place as you are. All the popular destinations are popular for a reason. So you want to make sure that you're planning ahead as much as possible to find, saver awards for your airline tickets and to find availability for the hotels you want. Your points aren't really worth very much if you can't use them. That's a full wrap on this week's episode of the Miles to Go podcast. Really appreciate you tuning in. If you're enjoying the show, I hope you'll take just a moment and subscribe to the podcast and then also give us a rating wherever you're listening, iTunes, Google Play. We really appreciate it, and we're already getting started on next week's episode. Until then, we've got miles to go.